So yeah, so first I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to discuss our recent work. And let me begin by thanking my collaborator so it's clear who we is or are. So first, George, who got me interested in this topic about 2 years ago and has been a continued support and, you know, full of enthusiasm ever since. My student Glenn Goodwin and my postdoc Lucian Kovac. Glenn has helped a lot on the work I'll discuss today. He's also working on some generalizations, and I'll show a little bit of his new results at the very end. Lucian is working on generalizations. I won't be able to show any of his results today, but he's making very good progress, and quite a few papers should come out fairly soon along the same lines. So, as you know, this is a very old problem. Polarons have been studied now for almost 75 years. It started with the paper of Landau in 1933. The hosting model itself is almost 50 years old. It's been studied extensively ever since it has been proposed. We know lots and lots and lots of things about it, maybe everything, or we're close to that. So let me begin with a slide to try to motivate why is it that we're still looking at this problem. And as you know, generically in incandescent matter, we deal with Hamiltonians that are sum of two parts, kinetic energy and interactions, each with its own energy, characteristic energy scale. Usually we can diagonalize, so we know the ground state and spectrum of each individual part, and they look very different from one another. And so trying to figure out what's the ground state and the properties of the total Hamiltonian, it's very difficult unless we're lucky enough that one energy scale is much smaller than the other one. So we can always define a dimensionless energy scale that's the ratio of the two. And as a function of this, we can calculate any quantity of interest to basically any desired accuracy in the asymptotic limits where lambda is much less or much larger than one, of course, using perturbation theory. But there's no generic way to tell us how to calculate quantities in the intermediate regime where the energy scales are comparable to one another. And of course, that's precisely the regime where many materials of interest fall. In particular, I guess most of the materials discussed in this workshop would fall in this sort of strongly correlated category. Now, what we can and we do a lot is use numerical simulations to find some answers about what's going on in this intermediate regime. But of course, that's not a universal. I mean, we can't find everything from numerics. There are always limitations in terms of system sizes that one can consider. Sometimes there are sign problems and the problem cannot even be solved. But even if it can be solved, there's usually big requirements for CPU, memory, long run time. So we usually only get some partial information from numerics. And so because of this, I think it's still important to continue to try to come up with simple, from a computational point of view, approximations, but which are still accurate enough to give us a good idea of what's happening in this regime. And the goal of my talk today is to try to convince you that at least for one problem, this Holstein polaron, we have managed to find such an analytical approximation that's very simple, but however it works well for all the values of the coupling, and not just for low energy properties, but for the entire spectrum. Now, this is interesting insofar that it proves that such approximations exist. As you'll see, it doesn't really uncover very much new physics just because this problem has been so much studied that we pretty much knew what the physics is. But this shows us that such approximations are should exist, and so the real interest of this work, I think, is in trying to generalize this to models about which we don't already know everything. So let me introduce the model. This is the simplest lattice model describing electron-phonon coupling. So there is some lattice, it can be in any dimension and can have any symmetry. And there are electrons hopping on this lattice. There can be the hopping can be of any time, of any type. All the results I'll show today assume that the lattices are simple cubic-like in one, two, or three dimensions. And the hopping is only nearest neighbor. And this is just because this is where we have numerics available, so we can make comparisons. But it can be any hopping, any sort of lattice. There is an Einstein mode of optical phonons. with frequency omega, and there are coupling between the electrons and the phonons. This is the Holstein coupling that couples the density of electrons at the site to this phonon operator, which of course is just the displacement of the of that site from equilibrium. Basically, the sort of picture I have about this is that as an electron hops around, it yanks the atoms out of equilibrium, it distorts the lattice in its vicinity. So as the electron moves along, it propagates this lattice distortion, which we can think of as a cloud of polaron with itself. And this composite object, the electron plus the cloud of phonons, is called a polaron, and we like to understand its properties. And because of this, I'll assume today that there's a single electron in the system, so we don't have to worry about contributions coming from interactions with other polarons. Even if there are no direct Coulomb interactions, polarons can exchange phonons, and so there are effective interactions between them. So for the remainder of the talk, I'll assume that there's a single electron in the system, and because of that, I won't care what spin it has, so spin falls out. And just another notice, because there are three energy scales in the Hamiltonian, can define two dimensionless parameters. The important one is this lambda, which is called the effective coupling, is g squared, the electron phonon coupling squared. 2dt, d is the dimension, so 2dt is half the bandwidth, whatever sort of hopping you have, this would be half the bandwidth, and omega is the phonon frequency. And so roughly speaking, if g is larger than this geometric mean of the hopping and the phonon frequency, then this is strong coupling. If it's much smaller than that, this is weak coupling. There's a second adiabaticity parameter, which is somewhat less important. This basically tells us what the coupling is doing. So we'd like to understand the properties of this polaron. And to do this, we'll calculate its Green's function, which is to say that instead of solving the Schrödinger equation in the one particle sector, so one here stands for one electron, momentum is always a good quantum number, alpha or whatever other quantum numbers we need. Instead of doing this, we'll calculate the Green's function, which is the usual definition, start from vacuum, no electron, no phonons, add an electron, use the resolvent, remove the electron, and you want to get back to the vacuum. And the reason why we're interested in this, of course, is that the Lehmann representation shows us that the poles give us all the one electron spectrum. The residues give us partial information about the wave functions. They're basically the overlap between the true wave function and a non-interacting electron wave function. So the Green's functions give us the whole spectrum, partial information about the wave function. If we want to find more information we have about the wave functions, we have to calculate more kinds of Green's functions, and that can be done with similar accuracy to what I'll show you for G of K and omega. However, today I'll only show results for this. Of course, we have to put a small broadening in to avoid singularities. So when trying to show what this function looks like, I'll plot its imaginary part times minus 1 over pi. This is an important function on its own. It's called the spectral weight. And of course, it's important because it can be compared against angle resolve for photoemission results. Now, I said in the beginning that usually we can solve the problem in the asymptotic limits. This is no exception. So let me show you what the results look like. If the coupling is zero, then of course, the effective coupling is also zero. The Green's function is just the free propagator. The spectral weight would be delta functions. I can't plot that, so I'll put a finite broadening eta in, and I see Lorentzians. So the spectral weight as a function of momentum and energy is shown here in one dimension, only half of the Brillouin zone from 0 to pi. For any value of the momentum, there's a single peak showing a single eigenstate with an energy that disperses continuously as we change k. And of course, this is just the free dispersion. Now, the problem can also be solved exactly if we allow the effective coupling to go to infinity by setting the hopping to 0. And this is called a Lang-Virchow result, and it's written here. First of all, you see that there is no momentum dependence. That's easy to understand. If the electron cannot hop, if the hopping is zero, then the electron is fully localized at the site. Any solution that's localized in real space is fully delocalized in k-space. So the spectrum is the same for all k values. Now, the spectrum for n equals to 0, we find the ground state from the poles in here, and that's an energy minus g squared over omega, that's called the polaron binding energy. And then as n goes from 1 to infinity, we have a sum over them, we have an infinite sequence of equally spaced levels with weights which are given by this Gaussian-like distribution. And so you can see that the problem that we're trying to address is not only how do we evolve from this ground state to this ground state as we turn the coupling on from zero to large values, but actually how does the whole spectral weight change from this single finite bandwidth band with continuous dispersion to this infinite sequence of discrete dispersionless levels. These two pictures are quite dissimilar from one another, and it's by no means obvious what's bridging them. So that's what. Sorry? Well, I mean, it's so for n equals to zero, yeah, this is one, and it's just the exponential.
Normalized?
Yeah, it's normalized.
So that number would be all in one.
Well, it's exponentially, so if, remember, in the strong coupling limit, G squared becomes very large compared to T and omega. So G squared over omega squared can be a very large number, and the exponential is therefore very small. The spectral weight, this is actually fairly important. So again, these quasi-particle weights, whatever multiplies the pole, just show the overlap between free electron wave function and the true wave function. And as you go to very strong coupling, the solution doesn't look at all like a free electron, and that's what the fact that the weight becomes so small shows. It's simply the overlap with the free electron. Okay, so we have to calculate the Green's function. We can always rewrite this in terms of self-energy exactly, and we know how to generate the diagrammatic expansion for the self-energy. We know how many diagrams there are, and so I listed here up to the eighth order the exact number of diagrams in the self-energy. As is usually the case, this number grows very fast. There's almost 2 million of them by the time we get to order eight. The problem is that one can show that this self-energy becomes convergent if we sum up to orders well above g squared over omega squared. G squared over omega squared is roughly the average number of phonons we expect in the ground state. So we have to have at least that many lines in diagrams to start to see the real physics. So, of course, if this is a small number, we can stop at a low order and there's no problem there, but that's perturbation theory. If this starts to become a large number, we clearly have a serious problem. There's no way we can sum all these diagrams exactly. Now, this is a well-known sort of problem that we encounter every day in condensed matter, and the usual approach to this is to just sum a subclass of diagrams and throw away everything else and sort of hope for the best. So in this, for such diagrammatic series, the usual approximation is called self-consistent Born approximation. It consists on throwing away the cross diagrams. So diagrams where two phonon lines would cross are all thrown out. As a result, one is left with much fewer diagrams, still an infinite number, but much fewer, and the summation can be done. Now, as you can see just from comparing these numbers of diagrams, clearly this approximation is not going to generically be a good approximation. There must be some very special reason why the few diagrams you keep would contribute a lot more than the huge number of diagrams that are thrown out, especially as the coupling becomes stronger and stronger. And actually, I don't really know if this is a good approximation at strong coupling for anything. It's certainly not a good approximation for the Holstein model, as you'll see. So we have to do something else. And our proposal is that has led to what we call the momentum average approximation. So MA stands for momentum average, and it's not one, it's an infinite number of approximations, so n sort of indexes which one we're talking about. But the basic idea behind these new approximations is very easy to understand. We're essentially keeping all the self-energy diagrams in the self-energy expansion, but we simplify the expression of each one enough so that we can sum them analytically. And of course, we can do the simplifications to various levels of accuracy, and basically that's what gives rise to a whole sequence of approximations. Now, let me say this without going into much details. Of course, if you're interested in details, I'll be very glad to discuss them with you afterwards. The way we do this calculation is actually not in terms of diagrams. We generate what's called the BBJKY hierarchy of equations of motion. So we write an equation of motion for the Green's function we're interested in, and we find that it depends on another Green's function. And we write the new equation of motion for the new Green's function, and it depends on another one, and so on and so forth. There is nothing perturbational in this series of equations of motion. Now, when one has such an infinite sequence of equations of motions, again, the usual way to deal with them is to just keep a few, truncate the series somewhere, and express the last appearing Green's function in terms of lower order Green's function so that there's a closed system and solve them. The problem there is that that sort of approach is, it's very hard to gauge how good or bad it is. What our approach is, again, is quite different. We keep the infinite number of coupled equations. What we do is we approximate the coefficients multiplying the Green's functions enough so that we can actually solve the infinite sequence of equation of motion. And these approximations that we make to these coefficients lead to approximations in diagrams, if you want to think in terms of diagrams. So let me continue with the diagrammatic explanation since... Yes. So first I just want to tell you what we're doing. It sounds a bit crazy, but then I'll tell you why it's actually not so crazy, and then I'll show you data. Okay, I'm just trying to build up the suspense. All right, yeah. So going back to diagrams, let me explain how the simplest and therefore the least accurate approximation, which we call MA0, works. And essentially, this consists in replacing each free propagator in each self-energy diagram by its momentum average. So there's just an average over the Brillouin zone, over the momenta. Here's where the dimensionality and the symmetry of the lattice goes in. Once we know the free electron dispersion and the lattice and all this, this is a function that can be calculated in many cases analytically, but it's known. So as you can see, the new propagators carry the correct energy or frequency. However, the momentum information is completely lost. And it turns out that if we do this, we can sum the resulting self-energy diagrams, and the result we get looks like this. It's independent of momentum. I'll come back to this. It's basically an infinite continued fraction in terms of the coupling, this function g naught of omega with various arguments. And that's about it. One can show that this converges, so one can figure out to what floor one needs to go before this becomes much less than one, and one can truncate. And so basically the calculation is just coming up n steps from where we truncate up to the upper level. It's a trivial calculation to make. One can write a program in Maple in 10 minutes to get this done. And so one can very easily generate results. Now, let me first mention.
Can I ask? So, sure. But it's because actually you only have one diagram left, or because?
No. I have the exact right number of diagrams left with the right topologies, except I put this instead of this everywhere.
But you don't have any K information anymore. So normally you have your kinematic restrictions, and so you lose all that, right?
Yes.
So that to me sounds like you cut a lot of contributions.
Let me go on a little bit. It sounds very surprising. And actually, I should say, the way we're doing this is not in terms of diagrams, but in terms of these equations. And I was just doing the approximation, not knowing what it means in terms of diagrams. And that's a good thing, because probably if I knew this, I'd have stopped and said, this is insane. It can't lose momentum conservation. But I didn't know, luckily. So let me just point out, before I go on and comment on this, let me just point out that this result is exact in both asymptotic limits. Obviously, if G is zero, then the self-energy is zero, and that's the end of that. But if the hopping is zero, that means that there is zero kinetic energy for the free electrons, which means that the free propagators do not depend on the momentum, because all the momentum dependence is through the energy of the free electrons. And if these are not functions of the momentum, then doing the momentum average won't change anything. And since we do some older diagrams, we must get the exact result in that asymptotic limit. And indeed, one can show that if we let t go to zero, this gives the same result as the Lang-Virchow approximation. The Lang-Virchow Green's function is not an approximation, it's exact. So if you wish, that's another sort of argument that we are really summing all the diagrams, otherwise we wouldn't be able to get that. Now, as you've said, and I fully agree with that, this sounds like a fairly crazy thing to do. So let me try to give you a couple of arguments why this is actually not so bad, and then I'll show you some numerics. So the first argument is that the ground state properties actually are probably going to be fairly well reproduced by this approximation. And to understand why, we have to understand what's the meaning of this approximation in real space. And of course, in real space, the propagator depends on the distance over which the free electron moves between absorbing or emitting new phonons. And what MA0 does is that in all self-energy diagrams, keeps only the diagonal term where the electron doesn't move. In all the self-energy diagrams. And of course, if there is zero motion in real space, if you write this in terms of Fourier transform, that's where you again get this momentum averaged Green's function. So for instance, something like this, where in principle you should sum over all the positions I and J over the entire lattice, if you make this approximation, then J equals to I, you just have this function that doesn't depend on position anymore. And you can see that the expression simplifies tremendously, and that's basically why we're able to sum them. So why should this be a reasonable approximation? Well, at low energies, we know that the polaron ground state is certainly below the free electron continuum. And at such energies, the free electron, this is the free electron propagator that appears here, the free electron cannot propagate, it has no eigenstate, so it can only tunnel from one side to another one. And as a result, one can show that the Green's functions at low energies below the free electron continuum decreases exponentially with distance, and the further down below you are the continuum, the faster this exponential decay. So roughly speaking, what we're doing here is we're keeping the largest contribution, the on-site one, and we're throwing away exponentially small contributions coming from electron traveling around. And you can see that the more complicated the diagram is, the more phonon lines are present while the electron is moving around, the better this approximation should be, because of course the more phonons are present, the lower is the energy left to the free electron, and so the faster this exponential decay. So this is a sort of argument why the ground state energy is probably going to be fairly well described by this approximation. Now let me try to argue that actually the whole spectrum is probably going to be working out fairly well, and to do this we'll look at spectral weight sum rules. So these are obtained by taking the spectral weight, which again is essentially the imaginary part of the Green's function, multiplying with powers of the frequency. As you've noticed, I have h bar equals to 1, so energy and frequency are the same for me. Integrate over the entire real axis. Now, it can be shown, actually one can generalize this for ground states which contain electrons, but here the ground state is the vacuum. It can be shown that these expressions are given exactly by this expectation value, so they can be calculated with some work. So we can calculate the exact sum rules, and we can compare them with the ones given by our approximation, and try to get some feeling. If we look at various k's and various powers of n, we should get some feeling whether the spectral weight of the approximation is at all similar to the real spectral weight. Now it can be shown, the details are in this paper. Again, I'll be very glad to go through it with you if you're interested. It can be shown that MA0 satisfies exactly the first six sum rules, so n equals 0 to n equals to 5 for all the k's. That might sound impressive, but it's absolutely meaningless. What's more important, or what's meaningful, is the fact that one can argue that MA0 satisfies with good accuracy all the higher order sum rules. And let me just stay a little bit with this point, because at least before I went through this exercise, you know, if I heard talks where somebody said we have this spectral rule that satisfies exactly one or two or three sum rules, my thought was, well, that must be pretty good. It cannot be an accident that it does that. After going through this exercise, I realized that the fact that the spectral wave satisfies a number of some rules exactly is totally meaningless. What's important is how badly it fails the one that it does not satisfy exactly. Let me give you two examples. One will be the self-consistent Born approximation, which can be shown to satisfy exactly the first four sum rules. However, as I'll show you, it gives very bad results in certain parameter regimes. And indeed, one can show that the higher order sum rules become worse and worse. A simpler example to see is this one. Compare this to spectral weights, one that has a single level in the origin, one that has two levels at plus and minus omega zero. Obviously, all the odd order sum rules are identical. They're all zero. So you can say here are two spectral weights for which an infinite number of sum rules agree. However, that doesn't mean that, you know, they're at all like one another. And we can see this from the fact that the sum rules that disagree, the even ones, become, you know, disagree more and more strongly. So the important thing is really that we can show that yes.
So these spectral weights are higher order correlation functions. This n, n.
Yes.
And when you check how do you calculate them?
So we can do brute force calculation, take Hamiltonian to power n and calculate this expectation value.
But it will be higher order correlation function.
Yeah, but it's on the vacuum. Yeah? Remember, so that's the main thing. I'm starting from the vacuum. Yes. But I'm interested in knowing the properties of the system with one electron, which means I start in vacuum, I add the electron, see what happens. I think what you're thinking about is if I was looking at the Green's function when I already have n electrons in the system and I add one more, so I'm looking at n plus 1 addition state. Yes? In that case, I have to. So one can show that the spectral weight, one can define two of them. So one for the electron addition part of the spectral weight, one for the electron removal part. And you can show that this is still true. So you have Hamiltonian minus En. So this is the ground state energy of the n particle state, Ck cross psi n. This is true, but the unfortunate thing is that we usually don't know what this is. So you can start the n equals zero sum rule tells you something about the average number of electrons in the system. And if you're lucky, you can maybe do the n equals one sum rule. But then you have to stop because you don't know what the ground state is. This is a special problem in that I'm only interested in starting in the vacuum and adding one electron because I want to know the properties of the single polaron. So because I know my ground state is through vacuum, I can. Oh yeah, it's a nasty calculation. So we went up to n equals 15, of course using MAPLE, and by n equals 15 you have 4 or 5 pages of things added together. I mean. So yeah, so in principle, if you knew all of these, you had the exact solution, but you can't calculate them. So I'm not saying it's easy, but it can be done. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, you can teach MAPLE or Mathematica to do the sort of expectation values for you. Otherwise,
and
for electrons. Yeah.
So it's just.
Yeah, you just order them, put them in normal order and see what comes out. So it's just commutation relations basically. Okay, so let me try first, again, without going into any details, just try to give you a feeling of what's the difference between how the MA approximation and how the self-consistent Born approximation fail the sum rules. So let me go to the sixth one, which is the first one where MA fails. So here's what the expression looks like. As you can see, it's already fairly messy. Each term is a power of energy to power 6, just from the definition. So this is T6, G squared, T4th, and so on and so forth. Now, MA0 basically gives all these terms as you see them, except that instead of these 18, gives a 16. So it fails by a 2D T squared G4. So what you can see is that in the asymptotic regime, so if G is the largest energy scale, then of course the term that has the largest G power will dominate the sum rule. If T is the largest energy scale, then this term will dominate the sum rule. Both terms are exact, and you can show that they're always exact in MA in all orders, and actually they should be, because I argue that the approximation becomes exact in the asymptotic limits. But for instance, if you look at this one, the prefactor in front of it just comes from the number of diagrams kept in the Green's function. So basically, of course, we can also write the Green's function in terms of diagrams, and what diagrams come up will depend directly on the diagrams that we kept in the self-energy. And you can show that this number just counts how many diagrams up to order 3 there are, roughly speaking. And it doesn't matter what you do to those diagrams. You momentum average, you make all the momenta zero, you can do anything you like to them. As long as it's the right number, you get the right expression here. Where it starts to matter what exactly you do to diagrams is in getting all these intermediary terms correct. And so this is how MA starts to fail, by just losing some coefficients because it doesn't quite have the exact diagrams. It has simplifications here and there. By contrast, in self-Kosinski-Born approximation, the diagrams that we keep exactly, but we throw many of them away. And so, for instance, if you look at strong coupling, the dominant term is not 15 g to power 6, it's just 5 g to power 6. So two-thirds of the large contribution is lost, and that's simply because diagrams have been thrown away. So again, it's just a matter of counting how many diagrams have been lost up to a certain order. And so let me show you some numerics to convince you of this. Here, there's lots of data where I take the ratio between the sum rule predicted by approximation to the exact sum rule. I'm showing the ratios because, of course, these sum rules increase exponentially. So if I put them on a real axis, you just can't see anything. All the data is in one dimension because it turns out that the approximation becomes better and better as you go to higher dimensions. So this is where it's at its worst. I'm showing sort of weak towards intermediate effective coupling 0.5. This is intermediate 1. 2 is already in the strong regime. If I went to smaller or larger lambda, the results would become better because, again, I'm going towards the asymptotic regimes where the approximation becomes exact. This data is for the center of Brillouin zone, so momentum is 0. This data is for the edge of the Brillouin zone, momentum equals to pi. The red dots are the ratio for the MA results to the exact results, and as you can see, the ratio stays close to 1 up to power 15. So it's exactly 1 up to n equals to 5, and then there are small variations, but still, it's staying fairly close. Whereas the self-consistent Born is exact up to n equals to 3, and then it starts to deviate more and more strongly. That's better seen here. For k equals to pi, all the spectral rules, all the sum rules are positive, so this is monotonous here. The sum rules change signs, so you have sort of crazy variations. But you can clearly see how this fell as you go to higher orders, and again, that's just because diagrams are being thrown out.
But this is when t, what's the middle parameter now, the value of the t, or omega over t?
So t is kept to 1, basically, and lambda is g squared over 2 dt omega. So this is 2. Omega was probably 0.5 t. I didn't write that either. I think it was 0.5.
Yeah, because you would expect if omega becomes larger.
Well, the better omega becomes, the better the approximation. As omega increases, the approximation becomes better. I'll discuss this also as I go on. The MA is 0.
That's a self-Kosinski-Born approximation.
No, as I said, that's basically bad everywhere.
I already looked at corrections which are for large omega more important because of the middle zero, right?
Yeah.
So it should work, it's supposed to work for small omega, not for large omega.
Well, I believe this is, I mean, the Migdal theorem is really looking at a metal. Yeah, it's comparing the phonon frequency to the Fermi energy. I don't have a Fermi energy here. I have a single electron. This is an insulator.
Yeah, but still, I mean, so, yeah, but omega over t will give you the Perkins equations. I think that's right. So if you throw away in self-consistent form. I mean, Migdal theorem tells you about Perkins equations.
Yes, so I think it's in a quite different context, though, just because physics is quite different if you have many electrons versus just one electron around. But question?
No, I have a question. Is your NA0 approximation somehow related to a inside DMST treatment of this problem? Or?
That's a very good question also. No. So I'll show you that the fact that the self-energy is momentum independent is an accident. We can fix that and get full momentum dependence. The Green's function is always invariant to translation. This is not an impurity-like problem. The self-energy looks somewhat similar to the one you get in the MFT, and that's not an accident because, after all, as t goes to zero, they become both impurity problems, and then they're both exact. So there is some structure that looks similar, but the functions that enter these the self-energy are different. So for a DMFT, you have to do self-consistency. Here, I don't have to do anything. I know all the things a priori. Okay, so it's really a different approximation. Okay, so I tried to give you some general arguments that this should work. Now let me show you results. So I'll start with ground state properties. This is ground state of the polaron as a function of this effective coupling lambda. This is the average number of phonons in the ground state as a function of lambda. The quasi-particle weight, so this is this number between 0 and 1 telling us how similar to a free electron the polaron ground state is. Again, function of lambda. This is the effective mass of the polaron in terms of the bare electron mass on a logarithmic scale as a function of lambda. The adiabaticity parameter is fixed here, so omega over t is 1. T is actually taken to be unit. These are in two dimensions. The dots that you can see are results from diagrammatic quantum Monte Carlo, so they're essentially exact. The two lines that I'm showing here are the predictions of perturbation. You can see that for the energy, they actually do a fairly good job. But for all the other quantities, we have the more usual case where the two predictions don't even intersect one another, so it's very hard to know how the system evolves from one limit to the other one. And let me just very briefly comment on the physics. You can see here basically two regimes. At weak coupling, we have what are called large polarons. Because the coupling is weak, the distortion or the number of phonons is very small. You see that the average is very close to zero, so most of the time the electron is by itself. Every now and then it creates maybe one or two phonons, but they are very loosely bound. They can travel very far from where the electron is, and this is why we call this a large polaron. It's large in a spatial sense. You can see that the quasi-particle weight is close to one, showing us that most of the wave function is a free electron, and the mass is basically very little renormalized. However, if you go at stronger coupling, then we enter there's a crossover to what is called the small polaron regime. Here, very many phonons are created in the polaron cloud, and because of this, the effective mass becomes larger and larger, and we see that the quasi-particle weight crashes to zero, telling us that we basically almost never see the free electron. It's always surrounded by phonons. And this is called a small polaron because as lambda becomes larger and larger, one can show that these phonons stay closer and closer to the electron. And in the asymptotic lambda goes to infinity limit, all the phonons are on the same side as the electron. So that's the small polaron. Now let me show you what self-consistent Born predicts. That's the new blue line. As you can see, it's okay at weak couplings, but even there, it's actually doing worse than weak coupling perturbation theory, so it's really not a good approximation. Let me emphasize this again. Even here, where it gives absolutely crazy results, it still satisfies for some rules exactly, so it really means nothing on its own. And now the red line shows the MA0 results. As I said, they have to be asymptotically exact if lambda is zero and lambda is infinity, but you can see that even in the crossover region, they approximate the exact numerics very well, again, especially considering how trivial it is to get these numbers. How about higher energies? Well, we can track the lowest energy of the system as a function of momentum, so these are three-dimensional results. This is the central point. These are various cuts in the brilliant zone. So this is the ground state. As we change the momentum, we see that the energy disperses. This is the polaron dispersion. The black dots here are numerics. The red line is MA0. This is the quasi-particle weight. You can see that this is in the intermediate regime. So again, sort of where you expect the approximation to be at its worst, because we know it's becoming exact. If you go to very small or very large lambda, it's still doing pretty well. The fact that this is intermediate regime can also be seen from the spectral weight. It's about 0.6 in the ground state, so halfway between 1 and 0. It always crashes very fast as you go to finite momenta, simply because if the momentum is finite, it is basically always convenient for the electron to have a number of phonons present, so the overlap with the free electron wave function goes to 0. So again, agreement here is very decent.
How is this for smaller omega?
Yeah, I'll give me two more slides and I'll show you smaller omega. Okay. Here's a comparison with basically, I think it's the most complete set of high energy data that's available in the literature. So these are lots of spectral weights. A is a function of k and omega in one dimension. This is the energy, and there are different panels for different momenta from 0 to pi. All these are for weak coupling, these are for intermediate coupling, these are for strong coupling. I believe here omega was 0.40, so also on the same order. Of course, the numerics people don't like to make omega too small either, because that forces them to keep very many phonons, and that's not a pleasant thing. Yeah. So again, the black line is numerics, the red line is MA. So for instance, here you can see that this is the ground state. It looks like a well, it's artificially broad, and they use an eta that was 0.4 omega, so fairly large energy scale. But this is truly a delta function if we let eta go to zero. So here's the ground state, and you can see that as we change the momentum, the ground state disperses, but the spectral weight goes to zero, so very similar to what I showed you here in three dimensions. Energy goes up, spectral weight comes down. You can see that most of the spectral weight moves to much higher energies, basically where the free electron would have its energy at weak coupling. As we go to stronger and stronger coupling, the spectrum changes quite considerably. So here we can start seeing the emergence of these equally spaced eigenstates. If you remember, that's sort of what we expect from Lang-Virchow. The ground state actually is below 4. You can't even see it on this scale. It has such a low spectral weight, such a low quasi-particle weight. If you follow these peaks, they hardly disperse. Again, it's a bit hard to see on this scale, but again, it's starting to look like the Lang-Virchow prediction. So basically, this numerical data would be more or less the answer that numerics can tell us, can give us to the evolution of the spectral wave from weak coupling to strong coupling. Now, as far as the comparison is concerned, as you can see, MA0 is doing fairly well. And I should say that here the numerics is no longer exact. They had to do quite severe truncations to be able to resolve the full spectrum. So there are some errors on both sides, but still most of the spectral weight is at the same energies and everything. So again, considering how simple it is to get the MA0 results, takes, I don't know, maybe a second or two to get all this data. It's still a good thing to have. Now, we looked at many other quantities that are available in literature. All this is shown in this paper. And in most cases, we have good or very good agreement with the numerics. And so the conclusion so far, hopefully, you agreed that MA0 looks to be quite remarkably good, especially considering how trivial it is from a computational point of view. However, this is an approximation, so we expect it to have some problems, and they're not that difficult to figure out. First of all, self-energy is momentum independent. The Holstein model is quite featureless. The phonons are dispersionless. The coupling is constant, but still there's surely some momentum dependent, so this is somewhat puzzling. The accuracy of the approximation worsens as the frequency of the phonon goes to zero. So let me show you some ground state properties. Again, these are one-dimensional results, and again, the same quantities I showed you before, ground state energy, quasi-particle weight, average number of phonons, effective mass, all as a function of lambda. The panels on the left are for a small omega over T ratio of 0.1. The panels on the right are for omega over t equals 0.5. Why these numbers? Because here there is numerics available. Now, the only important thing are the black dots. Those are the numerics, the quantum Monte Carlo results. The red line is the MA0 result. So you can see that for omega over t equals 0.1, there is already some discrepancy here. Of course, asymptotically, the prediction is good because it has to. The discrepancy is much bigger if you look at the quasi-particle weight. So again, it's qualitatively right, but this is quite serious. On the other hand, if you increase omega by 0.5, the discrepancy is already much less and the agreement becomes better. So clearly, if we make omega too little, we're starting to run into quantitative discrepancies. And finally, what's the real serious problem? Is the wrong location at weak coupling or outright absence at moderate and strong coupling of the so-called polaron plus one phonon continuum. So one thing that we know about the spectrum of the polaron is the following. Wherever the ground state is, precisely at omega above the ground state, there must be a continuum, which is called the polaron plus one phonon continuum. The origin of this is very easy to understand. Basically, if you excite the phonon far from where the polaron is, there's very little interactions between the two, so the energy is just the sum of the two. Of course, the momentum is also distributed between the two of them. Now, the phonon always contributes omega, whereas the polaron can contribute from its ground state energy up to whatever its bandwidth is. And so when we sum the two, we should start seeing a continuum, just the convolution of the two, starting at this energy and having a width that's at least the width of the polaron continuum. Of course, there can be more higher energy states at higher energies. Now, because of this, or because this continuum appears precisely at omega, it follows that the polaron dispersion cannot have a bandwidth larger than omega, because then that would mean that you have the polaron state overlap with the continuum, and that cannot be. And so indeed, if you look at weak couplings, well, the bandwidth can be less than omega. It cannot be larger than omega. And weak coupling, it's always omega. So here again, there's some numerics. Just following the polaron dispersion as a function of the momentum, the black dots are numerics, and the red line shows the ground state energy plus omega. And so you see that this is precisely omega, the polaron bandwidth, and there's a continuum starting here, which I'm not showing. Now, if you look at the MA0 results, they look fairly good in the ground state and actually for the other quantities, but clearly the polaron dispersion, the bandwidth is much larger than it should be. And this is bothersome because it's a basically a matter of physics that it should be omega and not more. So in MA0, the continuum starts at a higher energy, and at some point it basically just disappears. So we'd like to fix these three problems that I mentioned. And just generically speaking, anytime we have an approximation, we like to have some sort of systematic way to improve it and at least in principle be able to go towards an exact calculation. It's fairly easy to see how to do it here. So remember, in MA0, what we do is we momentum average every single propagator in free propagator in every single diagram, self-energy diagram. Now, if you think about where the worst errors come in, let's say for the ground state, of course, they come from the propagators with only one phonon present because these have the highest energy of all the propagators, so they're closest to the free electron continuum, and therefore they decay spatially most slowly. So we define MA1 as the approximation where we keep the free propagators with one phonon present exactly, and momentum average if we have two or more phonons present, and we can keep going MA2 if we keep one and two phonon the lines with one and two phonons present exactly, and momentum average from three onwards. Obviously, as we keep going, we're sure to converge to exact results because we're keeping more and more of the diagrams exactly. Now, interestingly enough, we can still do these calculations, and they're not a lot worse. So, as I said, in MA0, the result was one continued fraction. MA1, it turns out that the result depends on two continued fractions. It's still trivial. MA2, the result depends on three continued fractions and a little bit more complications, but it's still, so that's why I didn't write it here, but it's still trivial to evaluate. As you can see, by the MA2 level, we also regain momentum dependence. And actually, by from going through this exercise, one can understand why the momentum dependence is missing at the MA0 and MA1 level. And that's just the fault of the Holstein Hamiltonian, just because it's so featureless. For instance, if we have a model that has the coupling dependent on the phonon momentum, then even MA0 gains momentum dependence.
Why is there one momentum dependent?
Again, it just so happens. So, yeah. So, first, okay, so MA1 means that all diagrams where I have a single phonon line, I keep it exactly. So the first diagram, then I should keep exactly, yeah? But the expression for this is G squared G naught of K minus Q omega minus omega. So because G has no momentum dependence, this has no K dependence either. And you can just go through all the diagrams like this and convince yourself that because there's no momentum dependence here, you won't see it anywhere else. Yeah, as soon as this would have momentum dependence, or if omega had momentum dependence or something, if there's a bit more, excitement in the Hamiltonian, you'd start to see this. So I'll talk a little bit about these generalizations. We haven't tried this yet. I don't know about this. But this one, we're well on our way to understand how to deal with. Okay? So you see, MA2 has to have momentum dependence even in the Holstein model, because one of the two diagrams now has momentum dependence. One still doesn't, but one gets it. So because those are exact, at least that much momentum dependence we have to have in there. Okay, so let me try to convince you that going to MA1 and MA2 indeed solves some of the problems I mentioned. So we do get momentum dependence. I mentioned the discrepancy for small omega over T. So let me look again at these results. And remember, especially the quasi-particle weight, the dots are the numerics, and the black line was the MA0 result, and there's serious discrepancy at intermediary couplings. You see that as we go to MA1 and MA2, we basically halve the error. So if we went maybe about two more levels up, we'd fix things quite nicely. The error in the energy also is about half. So in principle, one can improve things systematically, even if you don't want to go to the bother, even if you don't want to bother to go to orders 3 and 4, which is of course becoming more and more cumbersome. It turns out that for couplings larger than about 0.2 T, so the omega to the bandwidth, if omega over the bandwidth is larger than about 5%, it's the bandwidth that matters, not T itself. If this ratio is larger than about 5%, by the time you're at the MA2 level, the approximation is already very accurate. And the larger omega is, the better the approximation becomes. How about the continuum? Again, here are some results, spectral weights for fairly weak coupling. The black line is MA0. Omega here is 0.5, which is this much. So if you look here above the ground state, you don't see anything. There's some another discrete peak higher up, and the continuum is actually way higher than where it should be. The continuum should always start at omega above ground state. As you can see, as we go to MA1 and MA2, we have this continuum appearing, and you can show that it's precisely the omega. There's some spectral weight rearrangement, but still, it's pretty much where it should be. I mean, it's exactly where it should be, and about the same weight in it, so it's sort of converging. Same for a stronger coupling, again, ground state. There's nothing at omega above the ground state, but if you go to MA1 and MA2, you see some spectral weight being pulled basically from these discrete states into these small continua that appear in between. You can also see that the ground state energy is improved a little bit, as you'd expect, because you keep better or more accurate expressions for the diagrams. You can also look at the sum rules and see that they improve. So MA0 was exact up to n equals to 5, MA1 is exact up to n equals to 7, MA2 up to n equals to 9, and so on and so forth. But more importantly, all the higher order sum rules also become more accurate as you go to a higher MA level. again, just because you're doing a better job in approximating the diagrams. This is the picture I showed you before where the MA0 was seriously overestimating the bandwidth of the polaron. Again, if you go to MA1 and MA2, you get really nice agreement with the numerics. So a nice picture of this continuum is shown by this sort of comparison. What I'm showing here are spectral weights for zero momentum. These are one-dimensional results. I'll tell you in a second why. Omega is 0.5 t. And this is spectral weight as a function of lambda. So if lambda is 0, I just see the free particle peak, of course, at minus 2t. If I turn on the coupling, I see how the ground state starts to decrease first slowly and then faster, exactly like in the pictures I showed you before. The quasi-particle weight also plummets to 0. It's never exactly 0, but it's exponentially small, and you start to have trouble seeing this. Now, if you look at MA0, there's continuum here. You can see a little bit of something in the background. And you can see that the continuum sort of lags behind instead of going always to be above at omega above the ground state. And it's always somewhere here, not where it should be. In MA2, that's already fixed. So here you can see nicely the continuum tracking down the ground state, except, of course, again, it has very little spectral weight. So it's harder and harder to see. But if you blow this up, you see that precisely about at precisely omega above the ground state, there's always a continuum that starts. And so if you compare the two, you can basically see that the main difference is that we have this tiny continua appearing in between the discrete states that suggest the Langfirchov spectrum. But the reason I showed this in one dimension is simply because in two and three dimensions, the weight in this continua is so small that you cannot see it on this sort of scale. You really have to look to use to blow up the pictures to see that there is something in there. So in one dimension, we can still sort of see this. And I think that's because in one dimension, there's singularities in the densities of states at the bend edges. I'm not really sure. Yes?
What a Bruner synthesis intercrossing continuum. How can that be something?
No, so here is a continuum. You start having a sort of resonance.
Right.
That gathers up at the sort of higher energy part of the continuum, comes down, and this is a true bound state. This is called the second bound state. It's a true quasi-particle state, and it's well known that it should be there. So that's truly a delta function. And so it comes closer to this, and then it goes back, and the spacing goes towards omega as it should be. So the stronger the coupling is, the main features are at omega from one another, which is what Langfirchov tells us we should start to observe. Yeah?
Still. So you have this one electron moving about and you remove it, right? And the final states are lit by omega zero, by omega, by your capital omega.
So what I'm showing here is the spectrum of, so if I put a free electron with momentum k, it will decompose in the true eigenstates of the interacting system. Yes? And I'm showing, well, here is k equals to 0. I'm showing where those eigenstates are, and the heights are just these quasi-particle weights, which give me some information about the wave function. Okay? All right. This is A of k and omega. I don't know, what am I not explaining well?
No, I would say that the final
That's
states
That's what
are,
it looks
are,
like.
So the final states are the states without a electron, with no charges. Is that correct?
So, yeah, let me write again what G of k and omega is. Yeah, so I put the electron in the ground state, the resolvent, which is let it propagate, and then I want to remove the electrons and go back to the vacuum. Of course, I can have different other things to begin and to end.
That's what you measure in photo.
Yes.
Inverse photo emission.
So if you, well, inverse photo emission
or
here, because it's the addition part. So if you could do it in an insulator, this is what you're supposed to see.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you could start from a full band and remove an electron, so have a hole would look just the same outside. Yeah. Okay, so sorry for running over time. Let me try to conclude quickly. So I hope to I managed to convince you that we have this hierarchy of approximations that are systematically more and more accurate, of course, at somewhat higher but still trivial numerical cost, which give us quite good results for what the Green's function of a Holstein polaron looks like. Now this is, I don't think it's very interesting as far as the Holstein problem is concerned because we knew already the behavior here. But I think this is interesting as a proof of principle that such approximations do exist, since after all that's not a priori obvious. Now as I said in the beginning, I think the interest is in whether we can extend this approximation to more problems. So we've started working on a number of generalizations. We can look at multiple phonon modes with Holstein-like coupling to each one of them. This can be done easily, and we've already published that. Generalizations to models with G of Q coupling, this is in a fairly advanced stage. So as an example is the Hamiltonian that was discussed in the first seminar yesterday morning. We call this the breathing mode of phonon. So electrons can stay on one sublattice and the phonons are on the other sublattice. Think, for instance, copper oxygen chains. If the electron is here, these two oxygen sites move in or out or whatever. And because now electrons interact with phonons which are on another sublattice, it turns out that the coupling acquires momentum dependence. The dependence is only on the momentum of the phonon. It's a sinus function. So here's some preliminary results. The numerics are exact diagonalization done by a student of George. Ground state energy is a function of coupling. Quasi-particle weight in the ground state is a function of coupling. The dots are numerics. The red line is MA0, so even MA0 here looks very good. This is dispersion for the ground state at intermediate coupling, 1.07. Let me just comment on this. So again, the agreement I think is very nice, and we're actually finishing the MA1 now just to have the continuum also work well. But basically, I just want to comment on the fact that here the polaron dispersion is not a monotonical function. As you can see, it comes down. And this is directly related to what we heard yesterday morning. We are told that at strong couplings, the second order hopping becomes larger than the first order hopping, effective hopping, and this just has to do with the overlap of the phonon clouds. And of course, the dispersion will look something like this, and if this term becomes larger than this, then we'll see the cost to Ka, which goes to zero, well, to minus one, I guess, as you go towards the band edge. So that's why we see this downturn is a direct reflection of that fact. So anyways, we think we have a fairly good understanding on how to deal with such problems. I'm working on generalizations to bipolarons. So of course it would be very nice to have two or more electrons, two in particular to find out the effective interactions between these objects. So I'm working on a Holstein-Hubbard model. Can't put the electrons on the same side either. And this is going quite well. I just stopped, but maybe I'll start again. So it's sort of halfway done. I think I'm quite confident that this can also be worked out with equally nice sort of agreement. Generalizations to multiple electron bands and phonon bands. So for instance, you have something like graphene, or if you have spin orbit coupling, or for whatever reasons you have multiple electron bands, you can still do the problem with, again, the same level of accuracy if you couple through Holstein-like coupling. And actually, I think you can also probably do it quite equally accurate if you couple to G of Q couplings, but we haven't done that yet. So, and of course, then there's all sorts of combinations that are possible. And one doesn't have to consider only electron-phonon Hamiltonians. Of course, there's many models where fermions are coupled to bosons. So in particular, for this sort of audience, if you have any favorite Hamiltonian that has roughly this kind of shape, I'd be very interested in looking at it and trying to see if I have any idea what to do with it or not yet. And so to conclude, this seems to be a decent strategy to get good approximations for intermediary couplings, at least for a, well, for what looks like a larger and larger class of problems. And sorry, yeah, so let me, as conclusion, answer the question I posed in the beginning, which was, how does the spectral weight evolve from that of a free electron to something that looks like Lang-Virchow coupling? So again, I'm showing results in one dimension, half of the brilliant zone energy, MA2 versus MA, just so you can see the differences between two. Lambda shows the effective coupling. When I start the movie, this should start showing the spectral weight. And I'll end up there. Well, okay, so you can see the polaron band, the continuum, it's absent here. This becomes flatter and flatter. Spectral weight actually decreases very fast. The color scale is not the right one, because then you couldn't see enough. So even so, you sort of lose the ground state. You don't see it anymore. It's here, and it goes all the way below 6, and then it comes back. You can see that the lower part of the spectrum looks precisely like the Lang-Virchow equidistant levels, which have the right sort of spectral of quasi-particle weights. And then if you come back, well, you start to see dispersion. The difference between the two, again, is in these continuums. They show more weight than they actually have, just because of the modified color scheme. And then as you go to lower and lower coupling, then you just have the polaron band and the continuum. And that's it. Thank you.
Dispersive phonons?
I haven't looked at that yet, and I mean, probably, yeah, no, I wouldn't comment. I don't know. So basically, the way this worked is I stumbled upon this approximation looking for something quite different the summer before. And until this winter, I had no idea why it works, really. I mean, it was obviously working. So about January or so this year, we started getting some feeling as to why it works. And now we can start figuring out how to generalize it to other models. And so we're making some progress. It's still fairly slow. I still don't have a general rule to tell you this works, it doesn't work. I don't know. So it's some sort of model by model that. I guess the good news so far at least is that we still find models where we can do something. It will surely stop at some point, but we're trying to push it. Yeah. Yes.
So you can still do Lang-Virchow transformation in effective way when you have
yes.
Also dispersions and of electrons.
Yes.
And then average out gets this exponentially reduced bandwidth, and people have discussed this approximation. How bad it would be compared to, is it somehow to have some feeling, is it somehow similar to this, what you are doing, or is
so,
it completely?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. So of course you can do the transformation, and you do that for strong couplings, obviously. And you can do then perturbation to figure out how the hopping, which is renormalized because of the phonon clouds, how is that lifting the degeneracy. So in the strong coupling limit, if T is zero, of course, problem is hugely degenerate, because you can have the polaron at any site. And then when you start making excitations, adding phonons either on that site or on other sites, the number of degenerate states increases like crazy. So then you turn on the hopping to try to see how this degeneracy is lifted. And people have made that calculation for the ground state. I don't think I've seen it for the first continuum. It becomes very nasty just because of the high degeneracy. So the results that were available prior to this in the strong coupling limit were just for the ground state, really. And maybe if you work very hard, you could get the first set of excited states. But it becomes really nasty to keep track of what's going on. Whereas this, you know, for better or worse, gives us the entire spectrum. So it makes life a bit easier. Okay.
Very impressive. Thanks.